This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Later this hour, we're going to revisit a conversation that we had back in April about the powerful drug fentanyl. We'll find out what it is, why it's on the streets, and why so many people are unable to manage the dosage of this potent drug. But first, Valerie's House is a Fort Myers nonprofit that works to help kids who are struggling with loss. And we were contacted recently by its founder and CEO, who says that she's seen a big increase in the number of kids who need help following the overdose death of a parent or sibling. As our society continues to battle this opioid epidemic, we're trying to connect our listeners to as many stories as we can about how addiction and abuse are affecting people. So on today's show, we're revisiting this topic through the eyes of the children left behind. We're joined here in studio by Angela Melvin from Valerie's House. Angela, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by two people who have found themselves seeking help at Valerie's House. Jeff Lampilla's wife, who was a Lee County school teacher, overdosed a few years ago, and now his two young children regularly attend Valerie's House for help. Jeff, thanks so much for coming in to share your story with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're joined on the phone by 15-year-old Freya Turner. Her sister died from opioids last year, and she has since been an active participant in the teen group at Valerie's House. And her parents also attend the caregiver group. Freya, thank you for doing this. We really appreciate your willingness to share your story.
No, I'm happy to do it.
Have you or someone you know experienced the loss of a loved one because of an opioid overdose, or maybe you've struggled with addiction and would like to add your thoughts to the conversation? You can always join us by giving us a call at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media, and on Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Angela, I want to start with you. Can you tell me a little bit about what kinds of services Valerie's House provides overall, and how long has it been around?
Absolutely. Valerie's House was launched 2.5 years ago, January of 2016, and it is a special place for children and their parents and family members to come after a death in the family, normally a parent or a sibling of a child. So the children come to us. We meet weekly and biweekly in grief support groups. So the children are actually with their peers and talking about the loss, their feelings, coping, the isolation they often feel. And what we're trying to do is just be a support system for these families. We've grown very quickly. We started with about 20 kids and have over 100 children right now in the program.
Can you tell me a little bit about your story and what led you to start Valerie's House? How did you decide to get involved in that?
My mother died in 1987 in a car accident in Fort Myers. And I was only 10 years old, and I had an 8-year-old sister and my father. So the three of us were left on our own. It's very tragic, as you can imagine. My mom died suddenly, and without any kind of preparation or plan, we were just thrown into this new life, and we were alone, and we didn't know any other families in our community that were dealing with this, so we grieved in isolation, and it was a tough time. My father held our family together, and because of him, my sister and I were able to thrive, but what we really needed was to know other children like us who were going through this, and I think that would have made all the difference in my healing. So that was my passion, as you would call it. As I moved back to my hometown a couple years ago and recognized there still really wasn't anything ongoing for children to grieve and heal together. So we started Valerie's House.
You know, and we've done a few stories here on the show that show that there's a kind of a shortage of psychological help for children, too, in our area. I mean, there are psychologists and psychiatrists around, but there are just not that many of them, and a lot of them are booked pretty far out.
That's right. Yep. And sometimes the children don't necessarily need another clinician or therapist in their life. They need just a community, a support system, and people that love and care about them. And that's what we do at Valerie's House. Very excited to be able to share more about this with the community, because I think there's still so many families that don't recognize that we're here.
Yeah, they might not know that you're there. Well, you just don't know when grief's going to hit you,
right.
You know? So you don't even have a plan in place. And then when you feel very lost. So when did you first start to see an increase in the number of kids that were experiencing the loss as a result of opioid overdoses? When did you see that?
We track every child that comes in, not only how old they are and who died, but how they died. And we have a pretty intense system. So we're able to assess right away which group they would best fit in. And what other services we can offer them. But right, I would say probably October of last year is when we really started to notice the spike.
A lot more, huh?
Absolutely. And it was before all of the news stories were hitting the way they are now. So it was really early on, and we were, you know, I oftentimes meet with my program team and who did we have, you know, inquire this week, who have we put into the groups, and it was constantly, you know, this person's family member died from drugs, this person died from opioids. It was an overdose. Sometimes it was a heart attack and result in connection with an overdose. So it was just immediately alarming. And what we noticed is that these families come in with a lot of complicated issues beyond just grief. Sometimes the child watched the parent or sibling do drugs. Sometimes they even witnessed the death. So it brought with it so many other elements than just grief that really we weren't even expecting or prepared for early on.
Having a loved one die from a drug overdose is far different from a car accident or cancer or illness or heart attack. So what kind of additional things are you seeing in your opioid family grief support group come up to the surface?
Well, I will tell you that it's different in the way that they died, but oftentimes the kids still feel connected because a loss is a loss. And we have groups, our grief support groups, the children, they're all in the same group. So parent could have died from cancer, could have died from homicide, car accident, and drugs. And they still connect and are able to help each other even though the loss was different. The opioid support group was launched really just mainly out of the concern of the parents that were coming to us, the caregiver who's now raising their child after a loved one has died from drugs. And the concern from a lot of the parents that were coming to Valerie's house was, you know, statistically, my child may follow in the footsteps of this person that died. And how do we prevent that? The stigma is just massive. You know, a lot of the kids in group, when we open up in a Valerie's house support group, we say our name and who died. And sometimes we talk about how they died. And children whose parents died from drugs will often say, I'm not allowed to tell how they died, or it's a secret how they died, or I don't know how they died. So we were seeing a lot of that. And that's when I started, you know, talking about it with some parents. You know, how about if we had our own group once a month where it's in addition to the other Valerie's House groups, but this would be a private group for these families and can really address and talk about some of these things that connect directly with when you've had someone die by drugs.
I would think it makes things significantly more complicated. Mm. If you're just joining the show, I'm talking with Angela Melvin. She's the founder and CEO of a local nonprofit called Valerie's House that helps children struggling with loss. And they've seen a large increase in the number of kids coming to them after a parent or sibling has died from a drug overdose. And we're also joined in studio by Jeff Lampila, whose wife died a few years ago from an overdose. His two young kids attend Valerie's House regularly. We're going to shift the conversation to him right now, but I want to also invite people to give us a call to get involved in the conversation as well at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Jeff, tell me your story.
So my wife, Ansley, passed away. It'll be 3 years ago, June 30th.
Oh, we're coming up on an anniversary.
We're coming up on an anniversary, yes. She was a school teacher in the Lee County school system, you know, very respectable. But unfortunately, she had, you know, those side effects. She was actually in a car accident while she was pregnant with my daughter. And that's kind of where it stemmed from because she couldn't get the treatment. You know, being pregnant, she couldn't get any really help.
You have limited options when you're pregnant as far as helping with pain management and things.
Exactly. So when she got off, after she had the kids, she started taking more pain meds, starting seeing doctors. I mean, they were prescribing her 500 pills, you know, walking out the door, morphine, Lortabs, you name it.
Oh, that was pretty easy access. And this was 3 years ago?
Yes. This is very easy access. I mean, and then she just have to go to certain pharmacies because those are the pharmacies that will fill them.
Oh, she kind of – there was a tip-off on where to go?
Exactly. And in fact, they just busted another doctor the other day right by my house for overriding.
Writing too many of these prescriptions.
Right.
So what were you – how long did this progress?
It was on and off for many years. She always battled with it, started in high school. But it's, you know, it got really bad at the very end. In fact, she was in solace care and other things, you know, at the very end.
And your kids were watching this progress as it went along. Did they ask questions about it?
Not really. They didn't. My daughter was obviously only a newborn, but my son didn't quite understand, and she would manipulate him into thinking that, you know, she was okay and stuff, you know. And it didn't really poke its head in, you know, really, really bad until the last probably three to four months, I would say.
What was she like in those last 3 or 4 months?
Oh, it was, you know, constant fighting, or, you know, she was too tired to do anything, too, you know. I would, you know, didn't wake up until 2 or 3 o'clock.
Just kind of checked out.
Oh, yeah. Totally checked out.
Checked out. But when she was awake, she was either – was she seeking these medications, these drugs? She was actively seeking or fighting with you about whether to get them or how to get more?
Yeah. I mean, her friends were involved in it. They all traded, sold to each other, stuff like that. And she would just, you know, we'd have that discussion. You're going out the door. Who are you going to see? So, you know, I understood where she was going. And, you know,
and then you're getting Mr. Controlling guy, and then you get the resentful look.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, why do you need to know where I'm going? You know,
I'm an adult. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's hard. And so your son was watching that, and your daughter is too young to really kind of comprehend, but kind of does.
Yeah. I mean, she's getting, she's only four now. So yeah. She's kind of understanding, but she still doesn't really, she doesn't know. She doesn't.
So what happened when your wife did overdose? What was your immediate reaction, and how did you see your children react?
My son actually blamed me automatically. The second I told him, he said it was my fault and stuff, because he had just seen a big fight between us. He thought, you know, daddy's the culprit. Through Valerie's house, and luckily through a lot of other people, he's kind of understood that, you know, it was nobody else's fault but her own, you know, and we have to deal with that, you know, to this day.
Well, the addiction,
mm-hmm.
For sure. Have you gotten on better terms with yours? How old was he when this happened? 10?
He was 5.
He was 5?
Yeah, he's just about to turn 9 next month.
Oh, okay. So how long have you had him going to Valerie's house?
It's just over a year now.
And you've seen him through going to this, kind of seeing what other kids are going through. Has he found comfort through that commonality, knowing that there are other kids that have the same experience?
Yes. He had major anger issues and stuff before we started at Valerie's house, you know. And since starting there, he has totally mellowed out. I mean, it's brought up other issues, but, you know, we're at least handling it healthy. You know, we're not trying to hide it. We're not trying to, you know, cover it up. We're trying to bring it out and, you know, make sure that he deals through each step of his life the correct way, instead of, you know, trying to hide his feelings, you know, because it might result going back to drugs for him, because kids are more likely to, you know, do that after a parent or a sibling dies.
Yeah, you mentioned before we went on the air that statistically it's 66% more likely. Is that what you said?
Yeah, it's 66% more likely to either use, overdose, or die from drugs.
For the children of people who have overdosed. Is that one of the concerns that drove you towards Valerie's house?
It's very much one of the things that drove me towards Valerie's house, and to, you know, help start this group. You know, because I, you know, there's many parents that don't even know that statistic. In fact, one of the girls that was involved just passed away in her death from opioids and other drugs.
Oh, one of the girls from the group?
No, from my wife's friends.
Oh, what, so, your wife's group of friends?
Mm-hmm.
When there are 3 years that have passed, how would you characterize those years as far as the arc of progression? Your son, you said immediately, was angry with you. Did he come to terms with things after having gotten to Valerie's house and having this kind of help? Did you talk about things out loud with your son in the very beginning? How did you cope with that? It's really chaotic, I imagine, right after something like that happens.
Yeah, we explained to him at first that it was mommy was just sick. And, you know, the typical boy, well, I didn't see her sick. He kept asking questions until I felt that he asked the right questions. Then I let him know exactly how, you know, in his language. And he has finally understood that it's the drugs and not, you know, not what daddy did, not what I did, not what somebody else did. It was, unfortunately, what the drugs did.
Yeah. And your daughter, did she ever start asking any questions? You said she was kind of too young to get it in the very beginning when she was, you know, when your wife was alive. She didn't really kind of see what exactly was progressing. But now that she's no longer alive, does your daughter have questions about where'd she go? Why'd she go? What happened?
Not yet. I have a feeling those are coming. She does ask for her a lot. She wants to know where she is, when she's coming back still. You know, trying to tell her that she's not coming back, you know, is very hard.
Yeah, I can imagine. Angela, tell me a little bit about these two different ages. Mm-hmm. How does a little tiny kid deal with this? And then how does an older kid that kind of gets what's going on deal?
Yeah. Well, when we initially started Valerie's house, the youngest child that we accepted was 5 or maybe 6, to be able to, you know, understand the death, understand that it's final. And what we started noticing was that a lot of these families did have younger siblings, like Jeff's family, and Jeff being a single parent now, where else is little Kinsley going to go, you know? And so we decided we needed to start what we call the minis group, which are little kids, you know, tiny ones, 2, 3, 4 years old. And so we do have facilitators and therapists working with kids that young. And Kinsley is one of them that comes all, you know, very often, rarely misses a group. And she is aware of that, you know, why she's there. You know, we always open up and even at her age, you know, do you know why you're here? And yes, my mommy died. And so she's able to say that. And that, like Jeff said, is really just, you know, the beginning. It's kind of owning it and accepting it and then being able to allow her the space to ask the questions as she matures. The different activities that we have at Valerie's house really involve art most of the time. So we did a rainbow on Sunday in our group where we talked a little bit about dreams and goals and things that we wanted. And even as a little 5-year-old, 4-year-old, you know, she's talking about, you know, wanting to see her mommy again and missing her. And so that opens it up. And then the other kids agree and they want to be a part of that conversation too. The 9-year-old, where I actually am the lead facilitator for Finn's, his son's group. And yeah, I mean, they want to talk as much as they can.
Do you see a lot of anger?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, we did an activity one night where we broke plates, where they actually took a plate and they wrote on the plate all the things they were angry about their special person dying, and we let them break the plate.
That could be very satisfying.
Yes, yes. They had goggles on and there were some safety issues, but, you know, but overall it was just a great activity. And, you know, the parents, the adults did it as well. So, but yeah, there's a lot of anger. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of guilt. You know, could I have been a better child? Did my mommy use drugs because I stressed her out? And so all of that is coming up, and that's why they have the group that they have at Valerie's house. So they don't have to stuff it inside, but they can bring it up and we can share about it and address it.
It's interesting how guilt really plays with grief, because even if somebody dies from something that you could not have controlled in a million years, a car accident, or maybe if I hadn't asked them to go pick up milk or whatever, you know, or you know, if I hadn't stressed them out, they might not have been as susceptible to the cancer cells. There's always going to be guilt. But I think that might be even greater when dealing with a drug overdose.
Yeah. And you know, Jeff can maybe jump in on that one.
Yeah. I mean, I think, unfortunately, I blame myself lots of times, especially this month, you know.
This is a tough month, I'm sure.
Did I need to have that argument with her? Did I need to question that, you know, did I push her to it, you know?
Yeah, someone told me a long time ago, looking back and regret is the worst thing because you always do the best you can at the time. And looking back and trying to change, that's never going to be fruitful. It's hard though, you know?
It is.
We're looking at the ongoing opioid epidemic through a different lens on today's show. We're looking at the kids that are being affected by the overdose death of their parent or sibling. And we've been talking with Angela Melvin, the founder and CEO of Valerie's House. It's a Fort Myers nonprofit that works with kids who've suffered loss. We've also been talking with Jeff Lampila, whose 2 children attend support groups at Valerie's House since their mother passed away. And we're going to shift the conversation now to Freya Turner. Her sister died from opioids last year. She's been an active participant in the Valerie House teen group. But we'd also like to invite you to call, and we do have one call on the line. The number for the record is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Freya Turner, I'm going to talk to you in 1 second, but first I want to get this call. Charles has been very patient on the phone from Fort Myers. Charles, what would you like to add?
Yes, good morning. Well, good afternoon. How are you all?
Great. We're doing good.
Good.
I just, Jeff, I wanted to say I'm sorry for your loss. As someone who's dealt in similar situations, it's easier said than done, but you cannot blame yourself. You did everything you could, and I tip my hat to you, sir.
Thank you very much.
The thing that bothers me about the opioid epidemic, and as someone who has dealt and deals with chronic pain, I have been to doctors, and they don't seem to care or focus on as much as they should on getting to the root of the problem, which is what is causing the pain. They just want to write scripts and move, you know, to the next patient. I have had doctors offer me pain pills, and I will tell them, no, I'm not interested. If you're not willing to get to the bottom of the pain, then I honestly don't care to see you as a patient. And it's just frustrating because doctors don't seem to, everything seems to be focused on the money. Move as many patients as we can. If we solve their problem, yay. If we don't, well, we'll just give them a script and they'll come back. And that seems to me to contribute to the opioid epidemic.
All right, Charles, I want to thank you for your sentiment and for your thoughts. I appreciate you calling in.
Thank you.
And now I want to turn to Freya Turner, who's been patiently with us on the phone, too. I want to hear you tell me your story in your words, Freya.
My sister passed from a heroin overdose, which she had problems with since I was 8. So you can do the math there.
So you were 8, and how old was she?
So we were 8 years apart.
She was 16.
Yeah.
And then how old was she when she passed away?
She was 21.
Okay, so you watched this during some of your more formative years?
Yeah, and it changed me a lot, because before that whole time I used to be much more cheerful than I am now. But when she was going through this, she would be on and off in palliative care and to different sort of places to try and help her get better, and I used to be the kid like, hey, where's Sissy going? Like, I want her back. I used to throw fits when she would go away because we were so connected. But I really didn't understand it until maybe when she moved off to Orlando, when she had to call my mother and tell her, hi, I've been taking out all this money because I'm a heroin addict. And I kind of realized why my sister was so distant than she was when I was smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of hard because then I was kind of beside her, going to meetings with her sometimes, and I had to take her to rehab places with my mom, and I was kind of confused but relieved. I was relieved to know she was getting help, but I was confused as to what she was getting help for, because she was my sister, and I didn't really see the problems in my head until she tried to commit suicide first, which was a failed attempt, luckily the first time, but the second time she unfortunately passed. Did I cut you off there?
No, I was just going to ask you a quick question. Do you feel that she was an intentional overdose or unintentional?
We know it was intentional because we did some snooping around in her emails, and she had a suicide note to us and a suicide note to her boyfriend at the time. And they were very specific, but apparently, to that, my mother has said I haven't been allowed to read them because apparently they are very intense.
Oh, you haven't read them, but your mother has, and she won't let you?
Yeah, it's that I've been wanting to read them, and I'm going to keep on asking, but it's a matter of me being ready, especially since before I went to Valerie's house, I was very defensive, and I was very angry and violent, and it would have made it much worse if I did read it.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
So when this first occurred, your sister first passed, did you immediately go straight to anger, or did you go through confusion?
I was the one to answer the door. It was 4:32 in the morning. I remember it was, and there was a detective at the door, and he said, "We found your sister's body." And it took me about 3 days to start crying because I was kind. You know, when something hits you and you're in shock and you can't cry.
Oh, I do the same thing. I go on autopilot.
Yeah, that's how it was.
Uh-huh.
My immediate thing was avoid what's happening and text and email your teachers that you're not going to be in school and kind of let it flow from there. But it was really hard to kind of comprehend that she was missing for a week and that's how they found her. They didn't find her alive. They found her that she had passed. But yeah.
And then 3 days later, you were able to finally cry. And then how did things progress from there? Did you go inside and lash out? You said you were defensive of her.
Defensive. I was very angry that she left me, especially in the way that she did. We were talking right before she left. We were chilling in bed and watching TV, and she's like, "I'll be right back," and she just kind of left, and I didn't notice that she actually left the house until I got up and realized her car wasn't there, and I remember exactly what I was doing, and I remember going to sit in the driveway and screaming because I had no clue where she was.
Well, was it scary every time she would leave?
Very scary, because when she did live with us, she would babysit me sometimes, and she'd be like, "I'm going for a walk," and then her car would be gone, and I would be scared, and I had to call my mom, and it was a whole fiasco.
You were kind of like a little police officer.
Yeah, she used to be like, "Why would you snitch on me?" But, you know, I was young and, like, kind of, "You're not supposed to be doing this, hey."
Yeah, it's really, I can't imagine what you've had to go through, but I wanted to get to how long it took you to get to Valerie's house. This happened, when did this happen?
Her passing away happened in 2015.
So now we're at 2018, when did you start going to Valerie's house to this specific group?
I think about a year ago, maybe. I'm not sure the specifics, because in the very beginning I was very angry that my mother was making me go to a support group, because we had gone to some other family support group that made me very uncomfortable, because there wasn't any kids there, and it was all adults, and I was kind of the lone kid sitting in the corner listening to the adults talk, and nothing relatable was happening. So
yeah, you're just kind of like, why am I sitting here?
Yeah.
But now you have other kids that are kind of your same age. Does that make a difference for you?
So much more of a difference. I got very closed off for a while. I didn't speak to many people. I lost friends. Grades went down. But when I joined Valerie's house and I actually realized that it was a good thing, I made friends and things started to get better, and I realized, dang, I was really screwed up for thinking this was a bad thing. This is the best thing to ever happen.
Isn't it shocking how talking about things can make them somehow feel less bad?
Yeah. That talking about it made it so much easier on me, because it was kind of like having something sitting on your shoulders 90% of the time and having no relief from it except when you sleep.
And even then, it's kind of sometimes hard to sleep, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. It's very hard to sleep.
How often do you go?
I go at least once a month.
Do you recognize your former self in some people that are first time walking in the door?
Yeah. I recognize the kind of wall that they have. Like, there's kind of something in front of them that they're trying to hide behind and trying not to let it all out. But I try to be as inviting as happy as I can to try and tell them that they're not alone and that we're nice people and what stays in that room, what's said in that room stays in that room, and we're there for one another. And
you know that delicate dance of when you're pushing too hard to get someone to open up and then how, when to back off, and you can probably read these folks better than most because you've been there and done that.
Right. It's all in the eyes. I've learned that.
It's all in the eyes. Angela, I want to come back to you in Valerie's house. Tell me a little bit about the different ways that these kids react. I'm hearing, like, it seems like the older the kids are, like towards teenage years and, you know, towards 10 years old, things, they get a little bit more defensive and angry.
Yeah. And I hear that from families all the time with adults. You know, I don't know if my child will come to Valerie's house. They don't want to go to a grief place and talk about their feelings and loss. And that's why we've done everything we can to make it. It's an actual house, if you're wondering.
Yeah.
It's a cozy little home in Fort Myers. And we also have a second location now in Naples. And it's not clinical. It's just a safe, warm place, teddy bears and activities. We have dinner and, you know, it's like a home away from home. So immediately I think that breaks down the wall.
Instead of a clinical,
yeah,
sitting on folding chairs in a circle
exactly.
thing.
No, they're on beanbag chairs on the floor and pillows. And but yeah, I think most kids will just immediately think, I don't want to go there. And then what we find is once they come, you know, similar to what Freya said and what, you know, Jeff's kids, like, they're like,
I'm there once a week.
Yeah. They're like,
three times.
Can we go back to Valerie's house? When are we going back to Valerie's house? And it really just becomes their family.
It sounds like a really comfortable hangout spot for people who have things in common with you.
Yeah, absolutely. And most of us who work there, we've all suffered a loss ourselves. So I am one of those kids in many ways. And when I hug Freya and I hug, you know, Jeff's kids, I'm like, I am one of them. And they know that. And so and several of the people that volunteer and work with us, we've all gone through it.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to ask you real quick, how is Valerie's House funded?
We're a 501c3, so we're your typical nonprofit and, you know, IRS designated, but we get a lot of money from local foundations and grants. Community's been extremely supportive. We are a United Way partner agency, so thank you so much, United Way, Lee County out there, who's been supporting us from early on, and just individual donors. Some of our families, although the services are completely free, we would never even want to think about charging, you know, some of our families give. So it's really just kind of a mishmash of different people in the community. It's all very local, and it's just been an amazing experience to be a part of it.
And are there ways for people to get involved?
Yes, we are looking for volunteers always. We are, you know, constantly looking for people who have ideas to support us and raise money and continue the momentum. We are young. We're 2.5 years in. So we know we have a long way to go, but we're pretty stable. We've got a great board of directors. Mm-hmm. FGCU has been a huge partner for us as well. We have a lot of interns from the social work department here who work with us. Mm-hmm. President Michael Martin and his wife Jan are supporters. So it really has been a community wide effort. And as I said, you know, it's really just about having courage to ask for help. If you're out there and you have had a loss in your family, if your child, even if it was 5 years ago, we have families that come to us.
Oh, that grief doesn't just disappear.
Yeah, that
no.
They're now hitting high school. You know, and they're now wanting to talk about it or acting out. And
or maybe start lashing out at different ages, right?
Yeah. We're also getting ready to start a young adults group, too. So
great. Jeff, I wanted to ask you before we run out of time, do you have any final thoughts for anybody?
I just want to say that the stigmatism comes along with, you know, parents or siblings that have lost somebody to drugs. It's not very, you know, it's very common for me when I say that to somebody, that their immediate action is, you don't do drugs, do you?
Yeah.
You know.
Maybe it's assumed because of your proximity.
Right.
Freya, did you have that experience with your proximity? Maybe people thinking?
Yeah, I've had a lot of kids from my first middle school be like, when I had the thing saying, hey, if you've seen my sister, she's been having some trouble with drugs and she's missing right now. They'd be like, are you on drugs too? Should we be concerned about you? I've been called to the counselor a few times because of it as well.
Oh, there's that closeness, that mm-hmm. proximity, being considered guilty for that reason. So that's an interesting thought to bring up. So that's not the sensitive thing to say.
Mm-hmm.
Asking if they do or other. Well, that's about all the time we have for this part of our show. But I really want to thank my guest, Angela Melvin, the founder and CEO of Fort Myers nonprofit called Valerie's House. Angela, thanks so much for your time and for your work at Valerie's House.
Thank you very much. And as I said, anyone out there who's grieving, just Google Valerie's house should come right up, and you can go ahead and send us an email, and we'll get right back to you if you want to be a part of the program.
All right. And also I want to thank Jeff Lampila. Jeff, thanks for being here and sharing your difficult story.
Thanks for having us.
I hope passing it along might help someone listening get the help they need. And also thanks to Freya Turner for sharing your story. Best of luck to you all in all things. When we return, we're revisiting a conversation we had back in April with the executive director of the Hazelden Betty Ford facility in Naples about fentanyl, the powerful narcotic normally used only under hospital-like settings, winding up on the streets and fueling the opioid crisis. I'm Julie Glenn, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.